Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Robert Glennon, the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona Rogers College of Law, and author of Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. He'll speak on the topic, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Professor Glennon's talk was given as part of the Watered Down Lecture Series presented by Creighton's Lead Art Gallery. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, October 6, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Robert Leager, Dean of the Creighton University College of Arts and Sciences.
Dr. Robert Glennon is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. The cogency of his ideas and writing has landed him spots as a speaker on National Public Radio, on Jon Stewart's Daily Show, and C-SPAN 2, in addition to his published pieces in various newspapers around the country. In his writing and commentary, Dr. Glennon addresses how we take water for granted and why the nation is in a water crisis. He uses very useful case examples of cities, Atlanta, Las Vegas, Buffalo, in the course of trying to make his case about this. He explores alternatives to enhancing the water supply and offers suggestions on what we can do to reclaim and conserve this finite resource. Dr. Glennon has a PhD in history from Brandeis University, a JD from Boston College, and for those of you who are liberal arts students out here, a Bachelor of Arts in English Literature from Boston College. He's been on the faculty of the University of Arizona College of Law since 1985, and before that was on the Wayne State University Law Faculty for 8 years. Dr. Glennon has served as a visiting faculty member in Puerto Rico, in Japan, at the University of Minnesota, among other places. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Glennon.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I appreciate the invitation and the nice introduction. If you haven't seen Matt's piece at the Fine Arts Center, you must. It's just a brilliant work of art. And if you care about water, and if anything I say today resonates, you're going to find an amazing, talented young artist who's sitting here in the second row. So engage him after the talk, and do get over there and take a peek at it. I've been asked to talk about the new book, Unquenchable, came out last year. And I'd like to do this in three stages. First, I'd like to talk about the nature of the crisis. Because, frankly, most Americans don't understand that there is a water crisis. I think you're different, you're here, you care about it. But still, I want to explore the dimensions, because I think even those of you who follow water will be surprised at some of the parts of it. Second, I'd like to talk about what we can do about it. There are some real solutions, but there are also what I call surreal solutions to this water crisis. And then the third thing is I'd like to suggest three things that we should do in the United States, but we're not currently doing to keep the crisis from becoming a catastrophe. So first, I have to start with a quote from an Arizona writer, Ed Abbey, a curmudgeon of the First Order, a real ornery character. Plenty of water in the Mojave Desert unless you try to establish a city where no city should be. And what would that city be? That would be Las Vegas. So here's the Bellagio Fountain. For some people, it's the reason to go to Las Vegas. For others, it's the epitome of wretched excess. When Steve Wynn wanted to put this fountain in, he came up with $40 million to build it. It occupies a footprint of 8 acres, it holds 27 million gallons of water, and it has 1,200 heads that shoot the water as high as 250 feet into the desert sky, all to choreographed music. It's really quite an amazing thing. And yet, it's really only the beginning. How many of you know about City Center, which is being built as we sit here this morning? It's an MGM Grand project. It's the largest privately financed construction project in American history. Pencils in at $9.1 billion. Quite astonishingly, it ranges the seven towers, range in size from 37 stories to 61 stories. Now, to give you a sense of scale, off here on the left side of the screen, that little shadow, you see that? That's the Monte Carlo Casino, which is one of the largest casinos on the Strip, and it looks like a tinker toy next to these towers that are being built. Yet something else is remarkable about City Center. There's only one casino. This is not about gaming. This is about Las Vegas having an unmatched capacity to reinvent itself again. People are buying condominiums in these towers from the States, from Canada, from the EU, from the Pacific Rim, not for gambling, but for the fine dining, for the boutiques, for the shopping, for the clubs, for the entertainment, for the shows, all of the other things that Las Vegas has. Now, there's only one problem. It's a big one. Las Vegas has run out of water. And the head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority understands this fully well. She's a little late coming to the game, Patricia Mulroy, but now she's had a conversion. And like many religious converts, boy, she has come at this new faith with a real aggressiveness. And among other things that she is trying to do to get people to conserve, she's paying people to rip out lawns, $2 per square foot. And they have put their money where their mouths are. They have spent $150 million, ripping out lawns. Second thing she's done, she's offered to build desalination plants on the Pacific coast for the cities of Tijuana and San Diego. In turn, Las Vegas would take those cities' Colorado River water rights out of Lake Mead and use them for the city of Las Vegas. Third thing she's doing, she's embarking on a $3 billion, with a B, billion-dollar pipeline to import water from groundwater aquifers 250 miles north of Las Vegas. Now, these aquifers are located on the border with the state of Utah. And if you think about your history, who settled those areas? They were the original pioneers of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And those people are not happy about Las Vegas coming after their water. But from my perspective, as a guy who kind of gets a certain kick out of studying fights over water, a fight over water doesn't get any better than one that pits Mormons against Sin City. There's one more thing that Las Vegas is doing, and that is they're running public service announcements on local television to try to persuade people not to waste water. And I'll show this video clip in a minute. We had a little problem with the tech, so let me just set up what's happening. There's a little old lady who's walking along past a lawn, and the sprinklers are watering the lawn, but also watering the sidewalk. So she goes up to the front door.
Can I help you?
To find your watering schedule, go to changeyourclock.com.
Las Vegas has a different sense about what's appropriate for television than some other communities. Not sure that the local public television station is going to be running a kick him in the groin advertisement anytime soon. Let's be serious for a moment, because she's trying to pay you to rip out lawn. She's trying to steal the Mormons' water. She's threatening you with bodily harm. But how can she possibly justify the water use by the Strip? Well, actually, pretty easily. Because when Steve Wynn wanted to put up that Bellagio fountain, he came to her and he said, look, this is my concept. I got to have it. Got to have a water feature. Don't tell me I can't. Just tell me whatever it is I need to do. And she said, Steve, are you prepared to put a reverse osmosis system in the basement of that casino, in the garage, to use contaminated water and cleanse it up, to use low-flow fixtures, instant-on hot water, to recycle all of your water? He said, I'll do it all. And he did, and they do. Every casino on the Strip uses recycled water for all those water features. And the stunning thing about the Strip is they only use 3% of Las Vegas's water, and yet they are the economic driver in the state, second to none. In Nevada, as in every western state, farmers use most of the water, between 70 and 80%. In Nevada, that supports a farming community of about 6,000 people. It's impressive. But it's also only the same number of jobs as a single casino presents. So when you start to look at the economic value of water, one of the things you realize is that the Strip is incredibly important economically to the entire state. Now, I start with Las Vegas because despite their naughty slogan about what happens there stays there, when it comes to water, that is the furthest from the truth, because what we see in Las Vegas is now occurring elsewhere around the United States. So one of our wisest founding fathers, Ben Franklin, we know the worth of water when the well goes dry. He was wrong. We Americans are spoiled. We wake up in the morning, we turn on the water, and out comes as much water as we want for less than we pay for cell phone service or for cable television. When most Americans think of water, they think of it as though it were the air, infinite and inexhaustible, when for all practical purposes, it's very finite and very exhaustible. The nature of the crisis. Just since 2007, Colorado farmers watched helplessly as their crops withered in the field. The state engineer told the groundwater pumpers to turn off their wells in order to protect the rights of senior prior appropriators. The little hamlet of Orme, Tennessee, literally ran out of water and had to truck it in. Scripps Institution scientists predict that Lake Mead, the principal water supply for Las Vegas, has a 30% chance of going dry by the year 2050. In South Carolina, one of the most humid parts of the country, a paper company, Bowater, had to close its doors, fire hundreds of workers, because low flows in the river prevented the company from discharging its waste flow. Nearby in Georgia, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission denied permits for two new power plants, not enough water to run them. Elsewhere in California, the Central Valley, well, they've had some recent rains, but the drought continues, and those economic losses already exceed $1 billion, and there is no end in sight. The largest of the Great Lakes, too low to float fully loaded cargo ships, requiring the offloading of hundreds of tons of freight and dramatically increasing the price of shipping. Off the coast of California and Oregon, the commercial fishing season canceled again, going into the third year, idling hundreds of fishing boats and decimating fishing communities up and down the coast. Three other western states, including my own, denied permits for coal-fired power plants. Scores of residential and commercial projects in Southern California canceled, and Atlanta, Georgia came within 90 days of having its principal water supply, Lake Lanier, dry up. Now, what's stunning about this litany is it's not the usual recitation of environmental degradation. It's not about low flows, it's not about temperature spikes, about salinity levels, about groundwater table declines, threatened or endangered species. No, no, no. This is about the health of the American economy. And we may fret in the United States about running out of oil, but water lubricates the American economy just as oil does. This is Lake Lanier in the middle of the crisis. Now, you would think, looking at this pitiful picture, that Georgia officials would have responded dramatically as they looked over the precipice and saw what was in front of them. But you would be wrong. Oh, to be sure, they imposed some modest restrictions on watering lawns, filling swimming pools, and washing cars. Beyond that, well, the governor decided he needed to do something dramatic. So what he decided to do was to pray for rain. And so he announced that there would be a prayer vigil on the steps of the state capitol. And he got together with ministers and people of faith, and they prayed for rain. But the governor, not a guy to take chances, because he didn't schedule the prayer vigil until the weather forecaster predicted it was going to rain. Then the state legislature got in the business, and the state legislature proclaimed in 2008 that the 1818 survey that set the border between Tennessee and Georgia was set erroneously, and that the border should actually be moved 1 mile north, which just serendipitously would bring that little hook in the Tennessee River down into Georgia, where Georgia could put in its straw and start sucking away till its heart's content. What the state of Georgia did not do amidst this was to put new restrictions or any restrictions on diverting water from the rivers or drilling of new wells. And to this day, even as we sit here this afternoon, you do not need a permit to drill a well in Georgia unless you are going to pump more than 100,000 gallons of water per day. And then you need a permit. And the permit is easy to come by. Now, in my simple-minded way, I think of our water supply as a gigantic milkshake glass. and I think of each demand for water as a straw in the glass. And what the law in most states, including Nebraska, permits is a limitless number of straws in the same glass. It epitomizes, for you who've studied ecology, the tragedy of the commons, but without going into any jargon, it just doesn't make any sense because you are going to exhaust the supply. It's only a question of when, not a question of whether. There's one other thing that Georgia did in the midst of all of this. How many of you know about Stone Mountain, which is a theme park outside of Atlanta? They brought a new exhibit or a new feature online. They partnered with Coca-Cola to create Coca-Cola Snow Mountain, and they issued a press release telling everyone why they were doing this. And the press release proudly proclaimed that research had disclosed that very few Atlanta children had ever had a satisfactory snow experience. You wonder how long it took them to do this research. You hope no PhDs were awarded as a result of this pretty commonsensical conclusion. So they decided to make the largest outdoor snowmaking project ever attempted, they said, quote, in this climate. And this is it. And they brought it online in the middle of a drought on a day when the temperature hit 81 degrees Fahrenheit. And these bozos are making snow outdoors. Well, it epitomizes the hydro-illogical cycle. What you've got is you start with drought, which makes you aware. That leads you to concern, but then you panic. But fortunately, it rains, and you return to a state of apathy. And that's what's happened in Georgia. They've made no dramatic changes since this drought of 2 years ago. 90 days they were within running out of water, and they have learned nothing. Now, you might excuse them and say, well, yeah, but it was a drought, and a drought, by definition, is a temporary aberration. It's going to return to normal. Not true in the case of Georgia, because the hydrologists who studied such matters found that there was nothing particularly unique about this drought compared to earlier droughts. Earlier droughts had involved the same levels of precipitation, low precipitation. But the consequences were so much more severe. Why is that? Because Georgia is the epitome of sprawl. It adds about 100,000 people to the metro Atlanta area every year. Interstate 75 that runs through Atlanta in one section is 15 lanes wide, and it's a bottleneck, bumper to bumper. So they're going to expand it to 23 lanes wide. We humans have an infinite capacity to deny reality. The same thing could be said about the state of California. Yes, they're in a severe drought, but it's no more severe than the one that ended in 1992. What's different is that since 1992, California's population has grown by 7 million people. So if you want to talk about the elephant in the room of the water crisis and of every other environmental problem, it's population growth. We nudged over 300 million in the United States 2 years ago. Yet the Census Bureau predicts that by 2050, in the lifetime of many of you in this room, we will be at 420 million people. Where do we get the resources, including water, for an additional 120 million fellow U.S. citizens? It's a challenge. And then you realize that in addition to overall population growth, there is internal migration. And people are moving from where the water is, like Michigan, to where the water isn't, like Georgia and Florida and Texas and California. And then you add on top of that global climate change with the dislocation and disruption of water supplies, and you've got a very, very tough situation. You have a demand and supply problem that simply don't connect. Now, the demand for water comes in all sorts of sizes and shapes. One of my favorites is this one. This is Kohler's power shower. It has 10 shower heads, each with the force with such force that you could take paint off walls. But none of them seem to get her hair wet. I mean, shouldn't one, if you're going to pay that much for a shower, shouldn't one of them get her hair wet? Then there's bottled water. I was the first to make fun of bottled water, point the finger at Nestle for its spring water campaign in my book, Water Follies. At this point, I think it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It can take six or seven times the amount of water that's in that bottle to produce the bottled water. It takes two or three times that amount to process the water, and it takes four or five times that amount to make the plastic. And then you've got the oil that's used and all the rest of it. But you know that, I think, by this point. Instead, I would suggest, if you have not yet seen the Penn and Teller skit on bottled water, get it on YouTube. Because it shows this fancy California restaurant, but instead of a wine steward, there's a water steward. And instead of a wine list, there's a water list. And the guy presents the list, and he's got the apron over his arm, and they're trying this water, and they're swirling it around like it was some fancy French wine, smelling it. And then the next scene shows Penn out back with a garden hose filling all the bottles of water. So there are some pretty indulgent uses of water and demands, but there are also some very important demands for water that for energy that use a lot of water and really haven't been explored, and one of these is ethanol. Now, I know ethanol is controversial for a lot of reasons, but I don't have a position in that particular fight, but I will call attention to how much water it takes. Because even if you have an ethanol plant that recycles its water, it still takes 4 gallons of water to refine 1 gallon of ethanol. So a 50 million gallon plant requires about 200 million gallons of water for the refinery process. But first you have to grow the corn. Now that isn't too bad if you're where we are or any parts further east. But the moment you go west of where we are, all of a sudden you have to be irrigating. You cannot dry land farm. And when you irrigate, it can take as much as 2,500 gallons of water to grow enough corn to refine 1 gallon of ethanol. And Congress has proclaimed that we should produce 36 billion gallons of biofuels in the next 10 years. Let me tell you what that means. In California, which has a goal of 1 billion gallons, that would require diverting every drop of water that goes through the San Joaquin-Sacramento Bay Delta that irrigates 7 million of the most productive ag lands in the country and that provides drinking water for Southern California coastal cities, all of that would have to be diverted into growing corn for the ethanol. It cannot be done. It should not be done. It's madness. And ethanol is only part of this energy disconnect. Our national energy policy has paid no attention whatsoever to the water consequences of various types of energy production, including, quite surprisingly, solar energy. Who would have thought it? Now, I'm not talking about photovoltaic cells, those ones that you see on a rooftop. They directly take the sun's energy and convert it to electricity. But they're not commercially viable at utility scale. What is commercially viable is something called concentrating solar thermal. And concentrating solar thermal takes the sun's heat to heat a medium, to boil water, to create steam, to spin a turbine, to generate electricity. This sounds like an old-fashioned power plant. It's because it is, with the single exception that at step one, you use the sun's heat rather than nuclear natural gas or coal. And solar uses more than these other kinds of thermal technologies. Now, there are ways to not use water, but they're much more expensive. And solar companies already are in a tough fight with low-cost fossil fuel production. Yet Congress has proclaimed that the Energy and Interior Departments should collaborate to site 10,000 megawatts of wind and solar in the Southwest. Where? In southern Nevada, in southeastern California, and in western Arizona. There are, as we sit here, applications for 150 power plants in this area. What's this area called? The Mojave Desert. Ed Abbey would be chortling in his grave looking at what we're doing to the Mojave Desert. So we have a need for a lot of water to produce electricity, but conversely, it takes a lot of energy to move, pump, cleanse, and deliver water. 1/5 of all of the electricity in the entire state of California is just moving pieces of water around and treating it. And we've paid no attention to this combination. Yet the demand for energy and for water is spiraling upwards. Here's one company that uses a lot of energy and water, but you wouldn't think so. I wouldn't even know what it is. It's not Sam's Club or Costco. This is Google. Yes, Google. Because while the algorithm they developed in its Mountain View campus is what they're famous for, this is what runs Google searches. Every time you press that request for a YouTube video or just any other kind of search, this cranks up. Inside this building are thousands of computers all hooked up, all generating heat. Think 10,000 toaster ovens, and you get the idea. But the heat has to be dissipated. What does Google use? Water. Because water is a great coolant, as we know from our automobile radiators. So what are we going to do about this crisis then? Well, there are some real but also some surreal solutions. Here's one, a billboard that's in Michigan of the Great Lakes. They fear that that Mexico, California, Utah, and Texas are going to come in and divert water and bring it all to the Southwest. Well, I'm from the Southwest. I just want to tell you that that rumor is nothing but scurrilous. We have no intention of diverting all of the Great Lakes. We'd be happy with one. So, realistically, there are some crazy, zany schemes along these lines. Periodically, you hear about some nutcake that wants to divert an iceberg from the Arctic or a river from British Columbia. Seldom do they ask the Canadians what they think of this idea. The most recent iteration is a guy in Colorado by the name of Aaron Millian. He wants to put in a pipeline, or build a pipeline, into Flaming Gorge Reservoir, bring it along tracking the I-80 corridor, and then south past Denver all the way down to Colorado Springs. Now, there are a lot of problems and obstacles that Mr. Millian faces. I'm not going to dwell on all of them. I'll just mention one, and that's something called the Rocky Mountains. So what else are we going to do? If these zany ideas are just nothing but surreal dreams, what else can we do? Well, what we usually do in the United States is we think we can engineer our way around it. There's no need to live within our means, to live sustainably. We can build dams, divert more water from rivers, or drill wells. But I want to tell you, those traditional options, business as usual, are not viable. Diversions from rivers, golly, you know, you look around at low flows in the rivers, so many of them are already hammered, temperature spikes, fish kills, and the like. Even major rivers like the Rio Grande and the Colorado, they don't even reach the ocean anymore. We have 100% taken the water out of them upstream. There just isn't room, with few exceptions, to take more water from our rivers. How about dams? Well, we're good at building dams. So good that we have effectively built one dam every day since Thomas Jefferson signed the Declaration of Independence. Reality today, we're not building new dams. There are no good dam sites left. We've put all dams on them already. Anyone who thinks that we're going to build dams hasn't been paying attention to the environmental pushback, the economic consequences, the regulatory nightmares that would be associated. The reality is we're taking dams out. Whether it's the Klamath in Oregon or the Penobscot in Maine, we're restoring thousands of miles of free-flowing rivers by taking dams out. Well, what about the third one? Well, that would be groundwater pumping, something you folks in Nebraska know well. And this is the poster child for tapping into groundwater with the Ogallala Aquifer. Parts of Nebraska have seen dramatic decreases in the groundwater table. Not as severe as in places further south, especially in the panhandle of Texas. But all around the country, that's what we're seeing. Earth fissures opening from pumping too much groundwater. Here you can see way up at the top is where the land surface was in 1925 in the San Joaquin Valley, but it had dropped to here by 1977. Incredible impact of groundwater pumping. And then there are the environmental consequences associated with groundwater pumping. Because the answer to this riddle of where does it come, where's the water in the river come from, is it comes from groundwater. Because the river is always the low point in the basin, and you've got land above it, and beneath that land is groundwater moving by gravity subsurface laterally to provide flows to rivers and to streams. Here's a sinkhole from Florida. You can see this fellow standing on the left side for scale. It's house-sized. I grew up in Massachusetts. Here's the Ipswich River from 2003. And a contrasting photograph from 2005. This isn't in Arizona. This is not a dry wash in the desert. This is a river outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Boston, Massachusetts gets more rain than Seattle, and yet groundwater pumping has had this consequence. So the big three, more diversions, more wells, more dams, are not going to get it done. So what else can we do? Well, some people think we can engage in cloud seeding. That is, take silver iodide and you dump it outside an airplane and you hope that that clouds will form and that it will rain. The scientific community is utterly agnostic on this. National Research Council issued an important report a few years ago that said, despite 6 decades of trying these experiments, there is no scientific evidence that it works. Yet we are willing to believe in almost anything, to believe anything is possible, to deny reality. So proposals for cloud seeding continue to be proposed and even funded. It's really quite a zany idea. How about desalination? Well, now we're actually onto something that works. Will it solve the plight of the ancient mariner? I don't know. But it will work. But it's not a silver bullet, single solution to the crisis. There is no such single solution. Instead, what there is a menu of options, or maybe a portfolio of opportunities, of things that we can do that will be fact-specific, contextualized, based on local communities to solve our water crisis. In that context, desalination will be part of the solution for some communities. But it's still troublesome. It's very expensive. The membranes that we use are extremely high-tech, costly, prone to fouling, require frequent replacement. Second, it uses a lot of energy. It's all done under high pressure, reinforcing the water-energy link and driving up the cost. And third, you have to figure out what you're going to do with the salt. Oh, to be sure, you've created some drinking water, maybe 50, maybe 60, maybe 70% of what you started with. But that other 40, 50% of the water now has 100% of the salts in it. You didn't magically get rid of the salt. And now you have to figure out what you're going to do with it. And getting rid of that brine concentrate is a devilishly challenging environmental problem. Still, if you have few options and a high value for your water, desal will be part of the portfolio. What else are we going to do? How about reclaiming water? Yes, we can do a good job with that. Now, there's some pushback. A smart aleck San Diego Tribune reporter referred to it as the toilet-to-tap proposal, ensuring that it was dead on arrival. But we don't need to drink the water. What we need to do is to use it. We in Tucson have the water company, Tucson Water, Municipal Water Department, provides about 10% of its water is reclaimed. We don't use it for drinking. We use it for irrigating golf courses, turf facilities, cemeteries, highway medians, ballparks, and the like, light industrial applications. Indeed, Google is now using reclaimed water in some of its server farms. The best part about reclaimed is it grows as the community grows. But it, too, has problems. It's very expensive. It requires a completely dual system of pipes and valves, painted purple to keep it separate from the potable system. And if you have an established neighborhood or community, then it's tough. It's easier to do this in an area of new growth, not of trying to rip up streets in established neighborhoods. Still, it has to be part of the solution going forward. What else can we do? How about conservation? Well, golly, it makes so much sense. And yet you have things like this from Senator Feinstein. God-given right to be able to water our gardens and lawns. Does she not realize that California is a desert? Southern California gets 13 inches of rain. We in Tucson, in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, get 12 inches of rain. Southern California is a desert that has irrigated itself with imported water, more water imported than any place else on Earth. What it needs to do is to take a look at this culture of lawns and rose bushes and azaleas. That would be a very helpful first start. Now, there are some very interesting things going on in the area of water conservation. This is a water harvesting project off of San Juan Island off of Seattle. The couple here had this silo put up, and they take the water that hits the roof of the house during the rainy season, store it in the silo, then treat it and make sure they sterilize it. And then they have a drinking supply. They're 100% off the water grid just based on the rainwater that hits the roof. Really interesting. I was just in Austin, Texas yesterday at this conference of rainwater harvesters. They're really, really going out there and being very aggressive. Over the weekend, I was in Detroit. There, they're doing it a little differently. There, the harvesting is for individual homes, not because they need more water in Detroit. I live there. It rains plenty. But because what they're trying to do is to take rainwater and keep it out of the storm system. Because Detroit, like many communities, has what's called a combined storm and sewer system. And when you get heavy rains, they combine, they overflow, you end up with raw sewage in the river. So by getting people to slow the movement of water from harvesting, you can take care of that. In the Pacific Northwest, that's going on in Seattle and in Portland. It's called green infrastructure. It's using swales and plantings to slow the movement of water so that you don't have to have the expense of treating it and so that you don't have runoff of street contaminants into the local waterways. So conservation is clearly a good way forward. But now I have to be realistic with you. There are communities like my own that is already reclaiming water. We can't desalinate, or we would, and is engaged in a lot of conservation, and we still need more water. So what are we going to do? Well, in the time remaining, I'd like to suggest three things that we need to do in the United States but are not currently doing. First, I want you to think back to Teddy Roosevelt. Civilized people should do something with sewage other than put it in the drinking water. Golly, he is so right. Well, why are we still doing that? A century later, that's what we do. We get delivered water from the treatment system. We only use 10% of that for cooking and drinking. Fully a third of it we use outdoors for landscaping. Of the indoor use, fully a third of that we just flush away, drinking water. We mix fecal matter into it and we flush it away. That's 6 billion gallons of water a day. Or 2 trillion gallons of water a year, merely to get rid of human waste. If you think about the American toilet for more than a nanosecond, it is a bizarre system that wastes water, wastes money, wastes energy, and it compromises or can compromise human health. Because the reality is that there are certain compounds, what the EPA is calling emerging contaminants, that traditional wastewater treatment systems do not remove. These are everything that we take that comes from the pharmacist, the modern era of the pharmaceutical industry, birth control pills, erectile dysfunction medicines, hormone supplements, antibiotics, whatever it is. We take the pill, our bodies absorb some of it, we excrete the rest, we flush it away, and that is not removed. And the scientists who have studied the water downstream from these treatment plants are finding deformed fish and intersex frogs. Pretty scary stuff. Now, I don't want to be a the sky is falling kind of guy, because these doses are measured in microscopic parts, measured in the parts per trillion. But the point remains, these are very powerful compounds, and we have no idea what the maximum human exposure dose should be to any of these compounds. And worse, there are multiple compounds. And it really depends on what people in the community are taking. And in one upscale Connecticut community, they sampled the water, and they found that on the weekends, cocaine and ecstasy use spiked. Now, you know, I don't care if you get high. I don't want to get high because you get high and then flushed it away. So what I argue is that what we need is to have a national commission, Congress has to get involved, to establish a commission to explore waterless ways to deal with human waste. Right now, the water and infrastructure system in the United States for sewage is in a terrible state of disrepair. It will take perhaps $1 trillion to upgrade it. Well, let's not rebuild the same old mousetrap. Let's take Roosevelt's admonition seriously. Already we have at the University of Arizona hundreds of waterless urinals around the campus. There are composting and incinerating toilets. Whether they're ready for prime time, I don't know. What I know is we've never even looked at this. And it's long past time to take Roosevelt's admonition seriously. Next, I want you to pay for water. We pay less for water than we do for cable or cell phone. And the reality is we don't pay for water. Even when you write a check to your municipal water department or to a private water company regulated by the State Public Utility Commission, all you're paying for is the, quote, cost of service. They figure out how much water does the utility need for the pipes and the energy and the plumbers and the like, and that's built into the rate structure, and then the rate structure equals the cost of them to provide the service. There is no commodity charge for water. And in fully a third of American cities, this rate structure has decreasing block rates, so that the more water you use, the less you pay for that final unit of water. Well, that's bizarre. It should be just the other opposite way around. So what we should do in the United States is we should first recognize a human right to water. If the richest country in the history of the world cannot make that commitment to its people, then we are a sorry lot. Reality, though, is that's only 1% of the water we use in the United States. So let's just do that and then talk about how to price sensibly the other 99%. The third thing, we're entering an era of water reallocation. And the reason is it's back to the milkshake glass. That's our supply. And so I have this notion that anyone who wants to put a new straw into the glass should be required to persuade someone else to take her straw out of the glass. This is a public resource, and the government has an obligation, a stewardship obligation, to ensure that we use this resource wisely. And one of the things that must finally happen is that development must pay its own way. And that is happening. It's happening in Utah. This is a photograph of the Utah Steel Company, a company built by the U.S. government, actually, during the Second World War. After the Second World War, they spun it off to U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel ran the company for several generations. But by the end of the 20th century, the steel industry in the United States is on the ropes. Pittsburgh has 100-year-old blast furnaces. Detroit is making automobiles that no one wants to buy. The young Chinese steel industry is aggressive in gaining market share. Geneva Steel struggles. Finally, they go into bankruptcy. They try to reorganize. They are unsuccessful. And so they needed to liquidate all of their assets. Fortunately, they had substantial assets to sell. First, they had the land itself. This steel mill was located just outside of Provo, Utah, where Brigham Young University is, right on the greater Wasatch Front, prime developable land. That brought in $46, $47 million. Then they had the steel mill itself with the blast furnaces and the whistles and bells. They sold that to a Chinese steel company for $40 million. They had an iron ore mine that brought in $10. They had pollution reduction credits that brought in $4. All told, that adds up to $100 million. And then they sold the water rights. Yeah, the water rights were worth more money than all of these other very substantial assets combined. This is the future of water in the United States, as it should be. What happened in Utah was that the state engineer, a guy by the name of Jerry Old, said, "I'm not playing the game of charades anymore. No more wink, wink, nod, nod, and I let you put a new diversion in from this stream, and I ignore the fact that the downstream prior appropriators' rights are going to get hammered or the environment will be crushed. Nor am I going to let you drill a new well, ignoring the fact that the water table will go down. That game is over. It's not a no-growth policy, but it's a development must pay its own way policy. So if you want to do a deal, bring water to the table." And that's what happened in Utah. Now, truthfully, this is an aberrational case. There aren't a lot of steel mills out there going under that are going to produce more water. There are some companies in Michigan have found ways to go waterless, or they've gone, unfortunately, out of business and freed up water. But the reality is, in this era of water reallocation, the water is going to come from farmers, because farmers use most of the water. And that raises some pretty interesting and very profound questions. What's going to happen to our food supply? What's going to happen to farmers themselves and the farming communities? I just finished a study with two economists of 12 Western states. We examined a 25-year record of sales and leases of water rights. So what we're talking about here is a form of water marketing. It's using market-based incentives to free up water for new high-value uses. And what we found was that there were 3,200 sales or leases of water rights. Most of them involved agricultural users either selling to other farmers or often agricultural to municipal, environmental, or industrial. And a lot of water changed hands. About twice the annual flow of the Colorado River was involved in these sales and leases. And what we found surprised us, because farm income held constant for inflation did not go down. Whoa, how can that be? Well, it can be for three reasons. One, farmers are savvy business people. And when that developer comes in and he says, you know, I'm going to offer you some money, they kind of look around and say, you know, that land up by the barn, it's all clay soil. Low yields and bushels per acre, let's fallow it. Or two, they say, you know, that's a lot of money that developer's offering. We could do some on-farm improvements. We could go from flood irrigation to a center pivot. We could line the canal. We could even go further and go from a center pivot to drip or micro. We can grow the same amount of crops with less water, improve the infrastructure, and free up that water for some other use. Or the third thing farmers are doing is they're readjusting their crop mix. So this is a photograph from Yuma, Arizona. Classic farm labor. It's harvesting iceberg lettuce. It occurs every winter. It's a tough way to make a living, I'll tell you, backbreaking. And that head of iceberg lettuce that you buy in the supermarket doesn't come like that. It comes with all these other leaves attached to it. And the worker has to machete all those other leaves off it. So another way of conceptualizing this photograph is all of this in the front is excess leaves or wasted water. It's water that was used to grow leaves that have no economic value to the farmer or to anyone else. So what this farmer decided to do is he said, I'm going to go with baby lettuces. And I dare say everyone in the room for the last number of years has been buying baby lettuces. And have you noticed how much you're paying for those boxes of baby lettuces? $8 for a box of lettuce. Well, the farmers have noticed it too. And they said, you know, this looks like value added to us. And this is how it's harvested. You have your basic tractor trailer rig on the left, and then on the right side, this is the equivalent of a gigantic electric razor, cutting off the lettuce leaves just above the root zone. The lettuce goes up this conveyor belt, goes to the back of the rig where there are empty boxes, the lettuce falls into that. The worker takes the empty boxes, moves them across on the conveyor belt up to the tractor trailer rig. When you've gone down the entire row, this is what it looks like. It takes four guys a couple of hours to harvest the entire field, instead of 20 guys an entire day. And when you're through, you run the tractor back down the row with some more fertilizer. No need for pesticides because the seeds are sown so closely together there are no weeds. You already have the roots coming back up. Within a certain number of days, you can do it all over again. You can't keep doing this, I'm told, because the lettuce will become bitter. But it's a very interesting and creative response of farmers to market conditions, allowing them to achieve greater value for themselves and their families using less water, freeing up water for other uses. So at the end of the day, and to conclude, what we're doing to water is the same as we did to the buffalo. We tried to harvest it to extinction. We're doing our best to empty that milkshake glass. We need to do better. But in the end, I'm incredibly optimistic, because is there a crisis? You bet there's a crisis. But the crisis is a time of opportunity. It's a time when there is still a path to be chosen, forks in the road, decisions to be made. And I've outlined lots of options. No single thing will do it, but a multiple-pronged solution, a portfolio or menu, will get us so that the crisis doesn't become a catastrophe. And now what we need, what we really need, is the moral courage and the political will to act. Thanks very much. Thank you. Thanks. Thanks very much. I think Aaron said that there was time for some comments or some questions. The fellow on the aisle here.
Thank you so much for your great talk. I want to just add the climate issue into the mix here. Richard Seeger, a really important paper in Science 2007, you're probably familiar with it. The model projections show an imminent transformation to Dust Bowl conditions in the Southwest, so mm-hmm. from Kansas to California,
yeah.
at 720 parts per million CO2. Susan Solomon at NOAA last year, important paper, at 450 parts per million CO2 to 600 parts per million Southwest is a permanent Dust Bowl. So right now, so the Copenhagen proposals take us right now to 770 parts per million. So if we enact what we presently have on the boards and we take these very important studies seriously, you have basically a permanent Dust Bowl in the Southwest. So I don't see how, one, I don't see how Las Vegas survives. I don't see that by the middle of the century you don't have depopulation of much of Arizona. That's one issue. The second issue is you mentioned concentrated solar power. To be able to fight climate change, concentrated solar power is one of the most important resources for doing that. So I'd like you to say just a little bit more about the level of water used, what it's used for, and maybe comment on how climate change plays in with the survival of Las Vegas and many cities in the Southwest.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's take the climate issue first. I mean, I did mention it in, when I was talking about the supply and demand problem. I think the scientific community is pretty much agreed about the reality of the warming. The question then becomes the projections about what happens going forward. And it's easier to do things on scales of hundreds of years than on tens of years. So when they start to look in closer, given normal fluctuations in climate and precipitation, it gets dicier. But you're absolutely right that all of the models suggest some range of decline in the flow of the Colorado River, from maybe a 10% at the most optimistic case to a 40 or 45% at some of the more pessimistic cases. So those are huge numbers. And remember that there's a lot of hydroelectric power generated in these western rivers. And so if you have declines in flows in the river, then you have less energy, and you need to offset that energy by something else, which in today's world means fossil fuels, which moves us exactly in the wrong direction. So I take the climate change issue very, very seriously, and I work with some of the people who are big in the IPCC report, and so I'm with you on that one. The solar thing, let me tell you about what I've just finished doing a study of that's not published. I agree with you. Solar needs to be an important part of it, but it's not happening. It's not happening. Yesterday, the Secretary Salazar announced that two permits for power plants on federal land would be granted in California. These are the first two permits on federal land that the federal government has ever granted for solar power plants. Okay? Happened yesterday. In 2009, the federal government entered into 1,900 leases with oil and gas companies. But only yesterday did the federal government finally issue permits for two new power plants. At the end of 2008, solar energy contributed 0.02% of the country's electricity. Minuscule. And if you look at the proposals that are coming down the pipe, there aren't that many. And some of these companies are already going bankrupt. And what you see, which has really surprised me, is that the environmental community has been unified with the theory of renewable power. But whenever a specific site for a power plant is proposed, suddenly the local chapter of the national group or individual citizens groups are opposed to it. Let me tell you the story of one plant that's looking to get a permit right now, and they may any day. It's called Bright Source Energy. It's a plant that has solved the water problem. They use towers, so there's no essentially a little bit of water for washing the mirrors, but they take care of the power problem. This power plant would be located in California, just south of Nevada, right on Interstate 15. Across the street is a natural gas-fired power plant. Within 3 miles is a 36-hole golf course, an outlet mall, and a casino. The site itself is about 4,000 acres. Now it's down to 3,600 acres of land. It is bisected by two huge high-voltage transmission lines. The land itself has been used for decades for grazing cattle and off-road vehicle use. In other words, this land is trashed. And still, it's now more than 3 years since the company first filed for the permit. They discovered 17 desert tortoises, which the company will spend more than $1 million each relocating. High-quality habitat, this is 6 square miles, high-quality desert tortoise habitat has about 250 tortoises per square mile. This had 17 in 6 miles. It's enough to drive the developers of solar power, who think they're doing the Lord's work, crazy. And they've come up with a new acronym. Instead of NIMBY, not in my backyard, it's BANANA. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. And that still may not be enough. Even if BrightSource gets its permit, that's one plant with 370 megawatts. But to satisfy California's renewable portfolio standard that Schwarzenegger approved in a declaration of 30%, California needs to come up with 600 square miles, or maybe even 1,000 square miles. And they're barely able to come up and still haven't agreed to these six. So I couldn't agree more with you that we need to go do better with solar. But solar has some wind and some water and some transmission line problems, and you're seeing an amazing amount of pushback from local groups. The principal pushback, let me go on just a little more, comes from the Center for Biological Diversity, and they argue three things. One, you should conserve energy, okay? Second, you should site photovoltaic on rooftops in urban areas. That avoids the transmission line problem. And third, you should use disturbed lands, old landfills, mine sites, and the like. All three great ideas, but I won't spend any more time on telling you. But none of them are going to do anything but provide a minuscule amount of power, minuscule. So if we're really going to do this deal with solar, the environmental community has to look hard in the mirror and say, we have to accept some power plants on public lands. We have to. Thanks for coming out on a beautiful day. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Robert Glennon, the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona Rogers College of Law, and author of Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. He spoke on the topic, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Professor Glennon's talk was given as part of the Watered Down Lecture Series presented by Creighton's Lead Art Gallery. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, October 6, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, and podcasts of selected Noon Forum programs are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.